welcome back to another edition of the ML Ops Coffee Sessions, a series where we talk a lot about ML Ops, but we don't have much coffee these days, sadly. Vishnu, I think, had some coffee in the frame. I saw you earlier with some. Yes.
It's always time for coffee for me, Dimitrios.
He's got some.
You just have to expand.
There it
mind.
Is. You're the one out of the three of us today with coffee because you're waking up right now. We have on the episode Mon, who is on the other side of the world, and she is not drinking any coffee because it is late in Australia right now. But I appreciate you coming on here and talking with us and making the time. Now, I know that you are an ML Ops advisor at GitLab, but I would love to hear a little bit about your story and how you came to be where you are.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for having me and thank you for making the time. So my story, it's quite interesting, I would say, starting with so I studied math, mechanical engineering and studio art. So a combination of lots of different majors. And then my career sort of went into doing a risk analysis for hedge funds, then into smart prosthetics, where I was using not cold machine learning, but prediction for bionic hands. And then I went into studying more on applied math in bionic hands and scoliosis. That was my postgrad. And somewhere down the lines, creep into being a data scientist. And then specialize in natural language processing. So a lot to do with clinical notes analysis. And then came to the point of scalability and version control. And not just spending time building one AI app. We want to build more and more. So bumped into MLOps. And from then, I just kept on journeying and transitioned to data scientist to more in the MLOps engineering space.
That's incredible. So I'm sure everyone out there that's listening is familiar with GitLab and how that works with CI/CD. But I'd love to know, maybe as the starter question, how you have been seeing MLOps being approached at GitLab and using MLOps with GitLab, because I was at a company, the company that I was at before the community happened, Dot Science, which went out of business, rest in peace. I know that they set up a lot of integrations with GitLab and they really leaned heavily on GitLab. And so I'd love to know, like, what are some ways that you've been seeing MLOps being approached by either companies that are doing machine learning or MLOps tooling companies that are integrating with GitLab?
I actually did work with Luke in DotSign as well in that integration part as well. So love that. So I'll first start, actually, I'll give a little bit of that full background as to just even from what our developer community are looking into GitLab when it comes to MLOps. So our developer community is obviously, it's a different sort of lens, which is not the data science lens, it's actually the DevOps lens. So the audience is DevOps engineers who've been deploying Java applications, Vue.js, and now suddenly they've been given this responsibility or this is sparked. And it's now, we need to actually talk to the data scientists and deploy this black box machine learning models, but we are not mathematicians. And so we already use, you know, GitLab for our DevOps platform. What do you have for us? So we can now talk to this new audience. So that's specifically like the that classical developer audience looking into embrace data scientists, not understanding anything to do with what constitutes being a model, but you've been asked to drop the cost of transaction from experimenting to deploying the model. So that's that developer audience. Now, from our the other vendor and landscapes, what they're looking at, what we're kind of looking together is really more fundamentally not just looking into the ML, your ML app or your machine learning algorithm. It's very much part of a longer journey of the full software development cycle. So the machine learning app may have a front end of that VUS and all of that. So how do you actually have almost like a fundamental pipeline that can orchestrate through all of this and look into that holistic way of where does that machine learning sit in your bunch of 500 software pipeline development? So how do we actually get into that integration journey, orchestrate that using, let's say, GitLab CI with DataRobot or GitLab CI with Pachyderm or GitLab CI with SageMaker, Qflow? What does that actually kind of look into that continuous training to deployment, then integrating into DevSecOps, integrating to GitOps as well as part of it, and expanding that.
That's incredible. And the scope is huge. I really appreciate that. And so my next question is around how you feel the best way to define CI/CD for MLOps would be.
Yeah, so I like to I'll define it in a much more I'll probably take the economic lens of it first, which is always sort of easy to define rather than, and then I'll have more kind of the technical layer. So most of the economists, when they look at AI as what does AI sort of mean and how does that impact? So they look at into that lens of, you know, demand supply. So mobile phones as, you know, the drop in cost of communication, and AI is basically the drop in cost of machine prediction. And so when there's a drop in cost of something, so if there's drop in cost of tea, people buy more of tea, less of coffee, and they buy the complements, which is sugar or milk, more. And that's the interesting part of that economics of it. So so when there is a drop in cost in machine prediction, people end up buying more of that. And the complement, which is human prediction, is basically that coffee and tea. And then the MLOps part of it is a movement that gets us closer and closer every day to cheap, almost automated machine prediction transactions. And that's complemented by this precise judgment and sharpening the decision-making process. So that would be my economic lens of looking into a CI/CD in MLOps. But what it technically just means is literally looking into a continuous, orchestrated, automated way of collaborating with your data scientists, with machine learning engineers or DevOps engineers in training, deploying, and continuous everything in this machine learning lifecycle.
Yeah, I'm glad Demetrios asked the question the way he did, because I think I always do like to zoom out, of the big picture and kind of think like, what really is this? I like your sort of economic point a lot. It's not just the product that, you know, people are buying more of, it's also its complements. And, you know, I'm right now looking at some roughly sketched infrastructure diagrams that we have at our company, where we have posited the idea of, hey, can we do continuous retraining or continuous training? Can we, you know, how does our CI/CD loop look like in the context of this machine learning model that we need to deliver for our device? Because I work at a medical device company, as our listeners know verbatim at this point. And my question kind of, you know, to you kind of in a big picture, kind of independent of GitLab is, you know, for companies that may not necessarily have figured out their entire DevOps sort of approach, philosophy, and tooling, how do you see MLOps and other tools kind of fitting in to that? Like, what have you seen in the market in terms of talking to your clients? Like, I'm sure there are plenty of companies that haven't necessarily figured out DevOps that are saying, okay, but now, you know, senior leadership is telling us we need to start building machine learning models and do all kinds of new things when we're still figuring out the thing that's, you know, that was hot yesterday. How are companies handling that? How do you advise them?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And I think everyone is in this journey in some form. So, and this will consistently kind of go on, right? So there will be companies going through app modernization journey where DevOps is not sort of practiced really. There's a lot of legacy systems and they're trying to figure that out. And then there is also this new shiny object or shiny team who build these POCs of great AI applications. And now it's time to deploy. And suddenly you're looking into, yes, MLOps, and you're hearing a lot of different things. I personally think this is how, and when I talk to customers, everyone seems to be in that different sort of journey. And the reality is it really actually depends on to a personal customer of what you want to make the decisions and how you go about that decision-making process of it. So at the end of it, if you want to have a MLOps first strategy, anything you are putting first needs to be substituted with what you had before first. So if you didn't have a lot of people are like, oh, we have AI first strategy. So it's like, okay, great. So what was your first strategy before that you're substituting that with your next strategy? So it's really, really important then what are your priorities? And so really, you know, it's like Google, right? Google went with mobile first. And then that mobile first was substituted with AI first, right? It's not like they just went and said, oh, we're going to do AI mobile and yeah, AI will just play along. So it's really about prioritization more. It's where you actually see how you can actually seamlessly do things and the culture. And the other part of it is really the people, right? DevOps is a lot to do with building a culture. And that part can totally resonate with actually getting and embracing it and starting it, learning from the DevOps culture and starting that in that MLOps space. So, and it's a totally different mindset, right? So when we talk about MLOps, we are actually talking a lot about modernizing machine learning. So it's all about this classical set of data scientists' mind where a lot of them are not even familiar with Git-based machine learning. So while the DevOps team may have done at least a little bit more research, may have not implemented that, but some understanding of what is actually Git-based. So there needs to be that culture of knowledge sharing, culture of understanding how you work in this agile, collaborative environment of continuous delivery. You can share it, you can prioritize which is important, and then almost start small and build together. And I generally think both can coexist. And it's really, really up to the decision makers.
I really appreciate the point that you mentioned about, okay, you may have a strategy now, but what were you really doing before? You know, what were you doing? Like, what were you actually doing? I think a lot of times I have found it very difficult to sometimes really answer in, you know, specs or whatever, like, where are we today? you know, because you realize that, oh, it's in a million documents. It's, you're not really, you know, you start to define what we should be doing, but you never really answer like what you've done already or what, you know, what you might be doing now. And I think that that's an essential part of actually figuring out where to, you know, sort of replace old practices and engage in that kind of modernization, as you mentioned. I think one of the interesting things that I think is in present in both MLOps and DevOps, and I'm curious to your sort of perspective on it, is a lot of the questions that we talk about in the MLOps community are kind of around how do we build? How do we want to go about with our development process, with our process of interaction amongst ML engineers, data scientists, ML scientists, and the DevOps team and software engineering team, based on the talent we have today, the priorities, you know, that we have for our organization. And in that context, it's really hard to say, okay, you should do these 10 things immediately. And I found some of Google's writings, Google Cloud writings on the MLOps maturity model to be very helpful mentally. I suppose from your standpoint, sitting where you're sitting at GitLab, which, you know, kind of has a specific development sort of, you know, workflow for its clients, and you may be playing an advisory role, like how do you sort of talk them through that process of figuring out how they build with respect to, you know, MLOps and DevOps?
Yeah, so before we even get into any sort of this frameworks of whether it's MLOps and DevOps, understanding the people, tools, processes, it's really first really figuring out what is that outcome. So if it's MLOps, really understanding what is the prediction engines that you're actually building, where is the judgment, where is the decision, where is the outcome, and how does this actually fit your full overall workflow? That is our first understanding of it before we actually go into even asking like, oh, do you practice CI/CD for, you know, DevOps? Is it not practiced in your ML teams? So before even getting into that, if it's our machine learning audience, it's really, really actually understanding, like from that business perspective, what is it that you're doing and where is it that, you know, where in that decision, action, outcome, and your overall workflow, and data collection to training to feedback, where are you all at, and how is this all interlinked? So from a strategy, architecture, modeling process, as well as governance. So and then it's almost like going into that maturity phase. We have like different frameworks of looking into, okay, are you crawling, are you walking, running, or flying, based on all these five different almost pillars of understanding that machine learning practice and sort of getting into that journey. So, but before getting into even understanding the maturity, because I think a lot of people struggle talking about the maturity in that right format, is really first understanding the outcome, and then rolling back, helping with the lens of our maturity understanding, whether it's the Google maturity framework, and we have our own, and then relating it accordingly and mapping the journey together.
So I want to jump in real fast and
yeah,
talk for a minute about the difficulties that you've seen with the idea of CI/CD in MLOps. And I know we've had quite a few people on here, and I've even written a blog post about this automation and how important it is to automate and when you should automate and how important it is to manually do something in the beginning, get it right, and then go to the automation. And so maybe we could talk for a minute about some of these challenges in the CI/CD for MLOps and the whole idea of automating, like maybe if it's the continuous retraining, when is that needed? What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, so it's an interesting one because this concept of having a automation also empowers collaboration in a very, very different form, and it almost in a way that most of the time, classically, data scientists and data engineers, their mindset is not structured to think about solving a problem in that way. So a lot of times it's when we talk about, at least with our customers, that, you know, with every commit of a code, you can trigger a DCI pipeline, and that can help with retraining to the of the model, registering, scoring, and then you can once it's scored and you're happy and everything, you can then go into the CD and containerize and deploy. That mindset, what I found is absolutely new to so many people. Like they can understand it in a high level way, but when it comes to actually productionizing that mindset, there's still a whole lot of cultural and education, as well as a full layer of complexity and understanding and aversion to embracing that sort of way. So I think that is one of still a lot of bigger challenge. And it almost feels very similar to probably what DevOps was when it started around, you know, 2008, 2009. It's still in that kind of like preliminary education ways of looking into it. And obviously with machine learning, it's quite different and it has its own complexities. So if you, a CI pipeline for an NLP model may look totally different. So it's got its own complexity, and it's got different sort of characters, and still a lot of data scientists at the end of it we meet who literally still are training models in their laptops. That's a lot of still customers. So these are sort of those challenges, and then particularly with CI. The one challenge that it comes is CI is actually, classically CI is a YAML file. and I think all of us, we need to rethink about how we introduce CI, because a lot of time data scientists, you know, they are not the engineers, and DevOps has embraced YAML. They just take it that we need this, we have this YAML file, we will, you know, have our jobs and stages written accordingly in a YAML. And so there's a little bit of the YAML literacy and education that was almost embraced automatically. Now, for data scientists, that's just never good. There's a fear of YAML. So for a lot of this classical data scientist team who haven't really even thought about, okay, we need a machine learning engineer who understands a CI YAML file. So there's a lot of these little things as well, which we have seen in a lot of customers. There's this education of or fear of YAML, and then you have to think about how you build your products accordingly. So and whether CI, it's not just about, you know, having YouTubes or giving education, but it's a totally different mindset. And tools should empower the data scientists to be left alone so they can do their job better rather than educating and be like, oh, let us introduce YAML. So I think all of us, we got to figure out ways to make YAML more friendly, make it more adaptable, innovate it. So at the end, data scientists are better in doing what they are really good at. So I think overall, all of us need to be better at it.
I think I completely agree with your point about the fact that this mental mindset of automation, the YAML literacy, there's so many challenges in what people know now in order to do things right, you know? And honestly, it's hard to blame data scientists, right? Sometimes it's, you know, and I'm not saying you're doing that, but, you know, even for software engineers, right? It feels like every day there's a new tool. It's like, you know, you haven't learned what was important yesterday, you know, maybe something like Kubernetes or something like that, right? And already, you know, you're seeing people talk about what the next version looks like. And so it can be very hard to keep up. And I empathize a lot with the people who are still, you know, developing on their laptop, because it's like, you know, somebody's telling you to do that 40 hours a day, and then, you know, you got to go figure out what to do next, what the next version of that is, often on your own time. So it's been kind of tricky.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I remember there was one time it was painful. I heard this was a client, and they spoke about the pain they go about versioning their model using spreadsheets. And so that world
wow.
still exists. You know, here we are having, you know, wanting to talk about best practice of MLOps, but we have so many to go into almost modernization of classical data scientists. Yeah. And everyone's in this different ways of it and different stages of it. And fundamentally, I think there's a gap in why, you know, there is not much productionizing of and people seeing value out of data, putting a lot of bet on data science workloads. So there's still a little bit of not seeing value on that. And the reality is there's so many of these little things that needs to be thought about and put together.
Yeah, I think it's the spreadsheet point is interesting, because, you know, I remember I was in a meeting once about experiment tracking, you know, it's like a community meeting for an open source project. And you know, we had a research scientist show up from an academic institution, and he was like, yeah, I'm interested in joining this and, you know, in learning more about how to use tools for this, because right now my system is basically a 100-page Google doc that every experiment I have methodically listed out what the hypotheses I'm testing are, what the results are. And I was like, wow. Like, hats off to you for constructing such an elaborate but manual.
Yeah, system. I've talked to people like that too. And the thing that I remember people saying was, well, before I started doing this, you should have seen we didn't have anything. So this is a step up.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, something's better than nothing. And honestly, you know, I think also I was having a conversation with someone else the other day about, you know, if you look at the terminal app on the Mac, right, and you look at like Bash and Zish and stuff like that, you know, that stuff can sometimes feel like it's from the 1980s or something like that, you know, like it's a very low level kind of feeling that it has to it. It doesn't have, you know, the terminal app doesn't have a lot of very fancy IDE features, right? But we use it so often as engineers, we are constantly playing around with, you know, shell scripting and similar tools. And so I think it's interesting, you know, it's kind of like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And, you know, if it works, you know, you got to respect what it does offer, right? And I think the way to approach some of this cultural sort of modernization, as you put it, can be to kind of sometimes just respect that when certain things work, they work, and you're not there to replace everything. You're just there to help people be more self-service and attain like a higher level of quality more easily. I think that's a realization that I've been having talking to you and you know, sort of some of the other people that have come on our podcast lately.
Yeah, 100% agree to it. I think the best way, tools and frameworks, all of it is to give people freedom to be the best version of who they are.
Yes.
And as a system, be able to be governed, have that controlled freedom so you can actually be more human. And so it's not, and that's not obviously MLOps, like you said, there's Kubernetes, there's so much more that is people are constantly talking about, you know, should we be going serverless to containers to, you know, it's a lot of different things. So at the end of it, it's at the end to make human decision-making easier. And so if it is the spreadsheet, so be it. But the reality is the a lot of these frameworks of CI/CD and MLOps, it's almost it's putting you for success for tomorrow. So you will come to a point where, you know, your Google spreadsheet will have a limit for petabyte model versioning. So you'll have so much data and you'll have so many models, it'll be beyond, you know, beyond the human discipline. And that's where it's going to get more fascinating, and people will need more help to just be better human. So and I think we are getting there. And some people are already there, and hence they are in a more mature stage in the MLOps. But that's the whole process.
Yeah, that emphasis on when things break, it's not going to be pleasant unless we do this to de-risk it. I wish I said that more often in some of my meetings, because I feel, you know, like as an engineer, you know, I'm still early in my career, but the kind of, not the pushback, but the context you need to give that I sometimes don't deliver as eloquently as I should is, yes, I can do it more quickly, but if/when it breaks, it will set me back much more unless I de-risk it now. And I think that is definitely something that from this conversation I'm going to be saying every day, you know, to my teams to really help make sure that we make the right investments early on. Doesn't make every investment, but make the right ones, because you got to know what you're doing. One question I have associated with this kind of, and this is a little bit of a different track, but, you know, we've talked about so many different great ideas about, you know, just MLOps and how data scientists fit into that and how to ensure quality and self-sufficiency and all these things. What resources do you recommend? What resources do you draw on? I know we just mentioned the ML test score. I think Demetrios mentioned that. I just mentioned the MLOps maturity, sort of a model that Google Cloud promotes. Are there any resources that you suggest in terms of MLOps education or rubrics that help the teams you work with productionize?
Yeah. So there's obviously tons out there, and it really is all about personalization. But there are a couple of things that is first really, really important is for me is really understanding the business outcomes of actually MLOps. So there's way too many tools, and everybody is in this journey building another set. And really knowing, and I think a lot of the customers, they struggle figuring out what vendor or what tool to go for what, and how do you integrate that with one, and how does it actually help with your full computation cost? So, and where does that sit, you know, because data scientists, engineers, there was a time when everyone's just spinning up a cluster, just doing any workload. And so if at the end, you're not able to drop the cost in decision-making, so where is all of this going on? So for me, first is really, really understanding the economics of AI and economics of machine learning. It's really the first key. So for that, I would say Professor Kahneman, anything about, so he's an AI psychologist, anything, any paper with him, he really, really nails down on human decision-making in reference to AI. The other is from University of Toronto, Professor Agarwal. He talks about that machine prediction and how it, in a C-suite level, and you can actually make these sort of decisions and embrace AI quicker and productionize faster. So once you're kind of in that journey, then it comes to more the cultural shift and what to automate and where does MLOps fit. So for that, honestly, when we come to that level, there's too many. We have our own in GitLab. we definitely there's Google. There is all the clouds have there. So Azure also has their understanding of maturity model, as well as AWS. So it really also depends on your, or if you already have a cloud native journey, you know, where you're comfortable, and we can help you accelerate in that way. If you are in that DevOps journey, if you're a Kubernetes customers and you've got your Kubernetes strategy, you want to deploy machine learning in Kubernetes, then it's a totally different sort of workflow. So let's look into how we're looking into Kubeflow and how GitLab works with Kubeflow. So the first part, the two things is really Professor Agarwal, Professor Kahneman, I always ask all the customers to actually go to that as my first resource.
I completely agree with this notion of the business outcome. I think it's a lot of success envisioning. That's the way I like to put it. You know, I think psychologically, it's one of those things that increases productivity when you know what you're trying to do. And Amazon puts it, you know, well in the context of their business a lot. You know, start with the end in mind. And I think, you know, kind of from a from a behavioral economics standpoint, you're also pointing out that there are these experts that have a lot of useful insight into how you can make decisions better as a team or with AI involved in the loop. I think that sort of perspective is incredibly valuable. One question I do have is, where do you see that a lot of people in the community of people that I work with are highly technical people. You know, for us, we are trying to build engineering systems. And quite frankly, the complexity of engineering is sufficient that I sometimes don't have a ton of bandwidth to think outside of my box, because I'm already overwhelmed with what's in my box. Where do you see this kind of perspective on the business economics of AI, and et cetera, really coming from in the clients that you work with? What parts of the organizations are functioning at a high level, and what is it that allows that part of the organization to bring that perspective effectively?
I think it's to your point. It's more the executive. So it's the team that's funding the AI application. So it could be a CTO to a group manager fund to whoever is it really. Looking into the ROI of the effort in the infrastructure, people, process, tools, in actually getting an outcome and sharing it with a wider team. That is usually kind of, so yeah, so you have your, there are two ways. So there is bottom up, which is that developers and really looking into, you know, how do you make that developer's life easier, better, faster. And then there's this other from that top down where, okay, embracing a framework like MLOps, how does that actually help in that drop in cost and decision making, make the team happy, have happier developers, and have better decision making frameworks so that we can scale it up. So today it's 5 models in production. By end of this year, we want 25 models in production. So it's usually those decision makers that are looking into it. But in reality, I think the best case of all of it is when you have a culture or a framework already where everyone has a voice and is collaboratively able to look into it together. So yes, the engineers are given their space to be working, but at the same time, they have a conscious mind of knowing how to work responsibly with it, right? So that goes with, you know, responsible AI, you know. So yes, maybe the data scientist is not the head of AI ethics, but there is a little bit of that collaboration and everything that comes together so people can make that decision as better together.
Yeah, the two components you highlight, there's technical process and then there is business capability. And what you point out is both matter, both have to be valued. It just tends to happen that there's a different, you know, sort of stakeholder for each. And I think that's important. I think I just realized for me too, you know, I think I want to do a better job of articulating at our company how AI really does enhance our business capability, you know, and what kind of engineering investments and technical process advancements we need to make in order for that capability to be able to be realized. right? That's really what you're not building for the sake of building. You know, you're doing it with an end, you know, with an objective, with a goal, with a profit seeking incentive, if we're going to talk about economics, right?
It's three layers. It's here, you know, what is the judgment that can help you with? What's the action that's gonna you can take with it, and how that outcome? It's judgment, action, outcome, and how does this fully impact the overall workflow? Mm. There you go.
Really, that's nice. That's a very nice framework. Judgment, action, outcome. I feel like you'd really like that.
Yeah, and I also, also am really big on this idea and how you broke it down, where one team really wants to enable the data scientists or whoever it is that is their end user to be able to get the most value out of what they're doing. And then you don't want these data scientists or whoever is their end user to have these mistakes or hiccups that we've all heard about, of maybe leaving a cluster on for too long and then running up a very large bill. So that fine line of enabling versus keeping the guardrails on is also fascinating to me.
Yeah, and it's a tricky one.
Yep,
that is the exact trade-off that I find myself struggling with work a lot, right? Which is how you want to balance flexibility with structure. You know, where do you want people making decisions, and where do you not want them? And that starts to get into what are people good at and what are people not, and then that starts to get into kind of difficult conversations about, maybe people want to make decisions that you feel like you don't really want them making. You know, for example, for us, you know, I just feel there's a great discussion recently. I'm just going to plug it in the Slack that was started by, I think a community member by the name of Henry, about, do you want Docker as an exposed layer to data scientists? And it was about split. You know, some community members were saying, no, you know, we don't do that. We basically have everything in like, you know, pre-written Docker files and sort of like pre-written layers, and we've written a Python library and that's all they interact with. And the other people are like, look, if you're not going to let your data scientists do Docker, why are you hiring them? You know, if you can't even trust them to figure that out, which is such a ubiquitous tool. So I think that trade-off that you mentioned, Demetrios, and that you know, you also kind of agree with, Mon, it's pretty tricky. It's like, that's kind of the hardest part of this MLOps stuff. It's like, what are you really trying to do here, and who do you want doing what?
Yeah, I think, and it then goes back to it's psychology of technology, and understanding the psychology of automation, right? So it's the same sort of you know, conflict we saw with, when do you use calculators, when you don't, with the rise of calculators, it's that same sort of, and it's almost like a healthy philosophical understanding of where the repetitive task can be automated, what is considered repetitive, and how much layers of that is automated, giving people that flexibility that when there is a new form of that repetitive task, there is still area of human creativity that comes with it. So, and that's where it's that balance of automation we've talked about. And then, and in that MLOps field, which area of it should you focus on first versus next, and how to orchestrate the full thing?
There's one thing that I wanted to ask just right before we move on. This comes up in my mind a lot, and I hear it a lot, especially when we're dealing with vendors and the different tooling companies that are out there. And one of their marketing ploys, or at least I look at it as more of a marketing ploy, is to say, we have the best practices baked into our tools. And I always wonder, like, that's something very easy to say, but what does that mean? What are these best practices that you're baking in? And I don't know if either of you have any comments on that, but I always find that really interesting, because there are examples that I've seen where it's like, yes, this is something that you should do and you want to do, and the tool has abstracted away enough to where you don't even have to think about that. And that's kind of what we've been talking about feels a little bit like that. it's like, yeah, there's some pieces that you don't even want to think about and you shouldn't need to think about. And so it's been abstracted away. But then what are these best practices that are being abstracted away? And maybe it's way too broad and way too difficult of a question to ask in the last 5 minutes of a podcast. But that's something that I notice in my head whenever I see those marketing ploys. I always think about that. Like, I wonder what those best practices are that they're talking about and who created these or who like gave the stamp of approval that these are best practices. Because I know there are cases when they are. And then I just wonder how much of it is just lip service and marketing.
I think I will agree with your curiosity. It's very fascinating because let's face it, we are all scratching the surface in MLOps. And the fact that there is a vendor who's figured every best practice whatsoever, when people are even struggling to, you know, figure out how do you embrace DevOps practice into machine learning. So it's fascinating that I guess it's words. And words having a meaning is a difficulty. So it's almost debatable. But I think what would be, and that goes with anything, it's how you communicate it. So there are probably certain things that is considered a repetitive task of data scientists that could be more in that best practice put together, having some version control is considered a recommended practice rather than actually saying that's the best practice. So here are the recommendations of maybe having version control, maybe having a platform to collaborate with data engineers, having continuous training. So I think, having a little bit more understanding of that. And I think to your point that can be very, very, very distracting and almost confusing and almost set a lot of customers in a biased way who don't have so much time to actually research, you know, what should the best practice be and what should not be. So, you know, because thankfully, we have the community where people can post the questions and we can talk about it. We can have a debate on it. But the reality of it is also that there is so many people who, and that's why, you know, I think we've talked about this even before, like, how do you know which vendor is doing which part? And because everyone says they're doing all and they're doing the best. So it's
really, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly that.
So it's like you spend hours just doing the research. I mean, even for me, right? Like if I want to do a GitLab CI with another vendor that a customer uses, and then, you know, when you look at their marketing blogs or just blogs and technical even things, it's like, yeah, it's everything ticked. And then you start playing. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, well, which part? Oh, you meant that's manual part or that's not. And, you know, so there's always that. So, yeah, I think we should probably all be very conscious of how we choose something where a lot of people are embracing new ways of doing things.
Yeah, I totally agree with a lot of things that you said there, Mon. And I think the one thing I'll add to actually a very good question that you asked, Demetrius, I do think that's a very good question, is I am coming to realize that what a lot of people call best practices are not best practices, they're just opinions. And you'll find, I think, a lot of times that, the most opinionated tools tend to say most strongly that they follow best practices. I don't know, that's just something I've been learning, I think. And I think, you know, it's like, this is a problem with jargon and sort of overloading terms, because I think the term best practice was probably useful when it really first started, right? That there was really a notion of something being a best practice. But over time, as everything, you know, and anyone decides started to become a best practice, it has ceased to become a really meaningful term and more of a marketing term. So I think I struggle with that, I'll be honest. But this has been a genuinely great conversation, very intersectional on the things that we talked about, economics, psychology, technology, how MLOps really fits into the DevOps paradigm, what it's trying to do with enabling data scientists and machine learning professionals. Thank you so much for coming on, Mon.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I am I'm so excited to be part of this community. I think I've learned a lot. Learning from everyone out there, actually. And I think this is so great. And I just hope this keeps on growing and we can educate everyone through this journey.
Totally.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for saying that about the community, about the Slack community. I think we would love to have you share your perspective on it and share us your sort of your tales and what you've learned. I think I can't emphasize how much I think Demetrius and I for sure learn every day. Okay, this is how people do it, doing things. This is how people have solved problems, and would love to have you be a part of that process.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.